dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black.
In a little more than a year, the United States flew $12 billion in cash to Iraq, much of it in $100 bills, shrink-wrapped, loaded onto pallets. Vanity reported in 2004 that at least $9 billion of the cash had gone missing, unaccounted for. $9 billion. Today we learned that suitcases of $3 billion in cash have openly moved through the Kabul airport. One U.S. official quoted by the Wall Street Journal said, quote, a lot of this looks like our tax dollars being stolen, unquote. $3 billion. Consider this theft as the American people sweat out extension of unemployment benefits. Last week, the BBC reported that the U.S. military has been given tens of millions of dollars to Afghan security firms who are funneling the money to warlords. Add to that a corrupt Afghan government underwritten by the lives of our troops. And now reports indicate Congress is preparing to attach $10 billion in state education funding to a $33 billion spending bill to keep the war going. Back home, millions of Americans are out of work, losing their homes, losing their savings, their pensions, their retirement security. We're losing our nation to lies about the necessity of war.
So take your pace easy. Go home soon like lightning. We soon will be riding my shiny black bed.
You're listening to episode 577 of Unwelcome Guests. Money equals debt equals war. I'm Robin Upton. And that was Denis Kucinich speaking on the floor of the House before the vote on another $33 billion sent to the war. Or was it sent to the financial bandits who were supposed to send it to the war? This week on the show, we're continuing where we left off last week. In hour two, we're going to hear another chapter from David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. This week, The Myth of Barter. It's highly recommended if you still think that money evolved from barter. Now in our first hour, we're going to continue where we left off last week. Edward Griffin is going to get on to the Rothschild formula, which is his name for the financial sectors organizing internationally, putting themselves not only beyond the reach of national governments to control, but in a position to organize international wars, and, of course, to profit from them. And this is Edward Griffin from approximately a decade ago.
You may say that it's unwise for the government to go into debt and to spend beyond its income. That's another issue. But if it has to do so, then at least it's borrowing money that really existed. It came out of your pocket. You had earned it. Or it comes out of the treasury of some corporation or a savings institution. The money already existed before the transaction. So no money is created in real, honest borrowing. Unfortunately, that is not the major part of what's happening with government borrowing in the world today. We come to dishonest borrowing, which is not borrowing at all. When the government obtains its money not from individuals or organizations or institutions which already have money, but obtains this from the central bank. Now, the central bank gives the money to the government in this fashion. The government writes out a piece of paper that says bond or treasury bill or whatever. And again, they put curlicues around the edge of it and put somebody's signature on it, stamps and numbers and seals. It's a piece of paper that says IOU. And they give that to the central bank. Central bank takes it and puts it in its vault, and it whips out its checkbook and writes another piece of paper with not so many curlicues and stamps and numbers on it, has a few numbers and so forth, and it gives the check to the government. Now, that check came from nowhere. I mean, it was just a piece of paper. The central bank had no assets to back it up, had no money in the vault, had no gold coins, had no investors putting their money into a savings account, had nothing, absolutely nothing. I want to stress that point. It just had a checkbook and a little bit of ink, and it wrote out this check for $9 million or $1 billion and gave it to the government. And the government takes it and deposits it into its checking account with Chase Manhattan or whatever, and now it can write checks against its balance and pay its employees and buy armaments and pay welfare and do whatever it has to do. Now, if you and I were to whip out a checkbook with nothing behind it and write a check and give it to somebody, we'd go to jail. But the central bank is authorized by law to do that. That is the Mandrake mechanism. The central bank creates money literally out of nothing and is authorized to do so by law. So the money then goes into the coffers of the federal government. The federal government starts to spend that money, and this newly created money, which is not printed on a press at all, it is merely checkbook money, which accounts for, 95% of all money in circulation is checkbook money, which means that most of the time it's nothing but magnetic impulses on a computer tape. That's all it is. That money starts to ripple through the country. Those who are closest to the government trough, of course, do the best. The ones with all the government contracts and the people on the payroll, they do very well. But then it comes through their checkbooks into somebody else's checkbooks. And finally, by the time it gets out to you and to me, we've got very little benefit from all this. Because by the time it gets to us, the prices of everything we want to buy with that money has gone up because of this process. So it's useless to us. That is the Mandrake mechanism. Now, they call this monetizing the debt. Isn't that a nice phrase? Whenever you read in the magazines that the government is monetizing the debt, or the Federal Reserve System is monetizing the debt, just mentally replace the word Mandrake mechanism. Now, I don't want to bore you with this, but you just have to know this. The loans then start to go into the banking system. Remember, it's not just the central bank here. They're the ones that set all this up. They're the ones that create this money by buying these bonds. But then this money goes into the other banking circles, and it's not just the money that was created by the central bank, but by the time now it gets into the commercial banks, which are regulated by the central bank, the commercial banks also have a chance to create money out of nothing. Because when the commercial banks get hold of this newly created money by whatever circuitous path it gets hold of it, it now calls this an asset on its books, and it can lend money 9 times, 10 times more than its assets. So this money that was created out of nothing for the federal government, by the time it gets into the commercial banks, is multiplied by 9 or 10. Tremendous leverage. And here's how it works. You might mentally picture an inverted pyramid like this. Now, granted, it's not a nice smooth pyramid. It'll be made up of blocks, some of which are wider than others. But if you sort of stand back and squint your eyes, you'll recognize that it's a pyramid shape with the biggest blocks on top and the little tiny one with a tip on it at the bottom. At the bottom of this inverted pyramid are the government securities, the IOUs, the Treasury certificates, the bills, the bonds, and so forth. These are issued to cover the deficit of the budget. These, now at the next level, are converted into currency. Some of it is converted into actual money that you can put in your pocket, but most of it converted into government checks. The next level in the pyramid is that the same IOUs now that the central bank is holding are also transferred into assets of the central bank. Now, miraculously, these little pieces of paper, these IOUs, now are carried as assets by the central bank. They are assets because they are assured that the government will pay them off, even if it has to wring every last bit of blood out of your hide to do so, because they have the power of taxation. So it is logically carried as an asset. The next level in the pyramid, these assets now are converted into loans to the commercial banks. The commercial banks get their money from the central bank. They don't just get it for nothing, they borrow it. They borrow it from the central bank. So these same IOUs were the basis for lending to the government. Now the same IOUs, because they're now called assets, are the basis for lending to the commercial banks. Sort of double dipping, you might say. Now, the loans at the commercial bank level are classified as reserves. Isn't it wonderful what these words can do? Now, they're on their books as reserves. The next level, these reserves are converted back into loans, but this time to the business and the private sector. And they are leveraged, as I said a moment ago, by about 9-1 over reserves. And finally, at the top of this tottering pyramid, as the loans finally become the bulk of the nation's checkbook and electronic money supply. So, abacadabra, zis boom ba, Mandrake couldn't have done it better. And it all starts with these little IOUs coming from the federal government. Now, think about that for a second. There are some very ponderous conclusions. One of the most incredible realizations is the fact that today every dollar that exists, either in the form of currency or checkbook money, and that includes the credit card money, the plastic money that is merely an extension of the checkbook money, all of it, in other words, our entire money supply exists only because it first was borrowed by someone. Now, it may not be you. You may be out of debt. But if you have money in your pocket, that is because it was borrowed by someone. Now, they owe the banks for this money, or you wouldn't have it. It would not be in circulation. And that means that every dollar in the whole money supply is earning daily compounded interest payable to the banking and the financial circle. Do you think you aren't working for somebody and you don't know it? The whole money supply is earning compounded interest for the financial masters of this country at one level or another. The money doesn't exist, I want to repeat this, until someone borrows it. A portion of every business venture, every investment, every profit, every transaction which involves money, and that even includes losses, even if the transaction involves a loss to someone, any transaction, a portion of that is earmarked as payment to a bank somewhere along the line. And what did the bank do to earn this interest, this payment? Did it lend this money out of its own capital? Did it take in all the savings of widows and hardworking people and lend it out at interest so that these people could have an honest return on their investments? No, it did none of these things. It simply made a bookkeeping entry, and it created the money out of nothing. Now, that's a pretty good scheme if you can get away with it. And they are getting away with it. And no one is really trying to blow the whistle because they don't understand the Mandrake mechanism. And as I said earlier, it is incredible. If you try to explain it to someone, they'll say, oh, I don't believe that. It couldn't be. Our government wouldn't allow that to happen. That's ridiculous. It was Thomas Edison. He was among the 1 or 2% who were able to see through this legalized scam. Now, he was kind of off in other sectors of his economic analysis, but on this one, he was right on. He said, quote, people who will not turn a shovel full of dirt on the project or contribute a pound of materials will collect more money than will the people who supply all the materials and do all the work, end quote. That's it. That is feudalism. It's not an exaggeration to say that the entire nation is working to support an invisible master, and doing so without resentment or complaint because, for the most part, the people are totally unaware of that fact. They have been economically conquered in a quiet war of which they have been totally unaware. Mariner Eccles was the governor of the Federal Reserve System in 1941. And on June 24 of that year, Eccles was asked to give testimony before the House Committee on Banking and Currency. Now, he didn't like to do that. And reading through that testimony is interesting because you think politicians can sidestep answers and be like a greased eel. You should read the testimony of governors of the Federal Reserve Board. They're masters. But in this one segment, he was pretty straightforward. The purpose of the hearing was to obtain information regarding the role of the Federal Reserve in creating the conditions that led to the depression of the 1930s. And we're going to talk about that later. Congressman Wright Patman, who was chairman of that committee, asked the question, how did you get the money to buy those $2 billion worth of government securities in 1933? Eccles answered, we created it. Patman, out of what? Answer, out of the right to issue credit money. Question, and there is nothing behind it, is there, except our government's credit? Answer, that's what our money system is. If there were no debts in our money system, there wouldn't be any money. End quote. Robert Hemphill was the former credit manager of the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta. Now, he's speaking from a position of firsthand knowledge. In the foreword to a book by Irving Fisher entitled 100% Money, Hemphill said this, quote, if all the bank loans were paid, no one could have a bank deposit, and there would not be a dollar of coin or currency in circulation. This is a staggering thought. Someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation. When one gets a complete grasp of the picture, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless situation is almost incredible. But there it is. End quote. And so, literally, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a hyperbole, this is not an exaggeration to make a point. Literally, the entire money system of the United States and of the world today is built upon debt. And who benefits from this debt? Well, he who collects the interest, of course. Now, that word interest, does that mean what it says? It's another one of the deceptive vocabulary. It is not interest, ladies and gentlemen. It would be interest if you were paying on real money that was borrowed, but this is not real money that was borrowed. This was created out of nothing. What this really is a royalty to the political and monetary scientists who created the money. You're paying them a royalty for their service. Or if you wish to be even more hard-nosed about it, I would suggest that we are paying them a tribute. We are paying a tribute to our economic conquerors. But whatever you want to call it, we're paying it every hour of every day we live. And when you finally come to this understanding of this reality, you then will understand the Mandrake mechanism and why it is so important to the success of the cabal. I'd like to talk about the House of Rothschild. We have established that the money of today will eventually collapse because it is worthless. We have seen also how this fiat money is created. Now let's turn to history and see how it came to be that way. This master plan surfaced to view for the first time fully in England in the late 1600s. After half a century of war against France and in civil wars, England was financially exhausted, and by 1693, the people of England with money were not very willing to finance the government any longer. Now, the government wanted to engage in the War of the League of Augsburg and was having a great deal of difficulty raising the money for that war because they had been very slow to pay off their debts in the past. King William had difficulty borrowing because of this, and he was reluctant to raise taxes any further. The taxes were already quite high, and especially since taxes were one of the major reasons for the civil wars. So King William and Parliament found itself in that typical jam that governments do. They want more money, they can't borrow it easily, and they are afraid to raise taxes, so what do? So the two groups that I mentioned before came together for the first time in history to formulate a plan. The political scientists formed a committee of the House of Commons to explore ways to raise money for that war. At the same time, the monetary scientists, consisting of a group of bankers who met to explore ways to create the money for the government at no expense. Now, this group was heavily influenced by the Bank of Amsterdam, but it was in London, at least, it was led and dominated by a Scottish financier by the name of William Paterson. The cabal was forged when these two groups came together and agreed upon a seven-point plan. The first was that the bankers would provide all the money that was needed for the government. The second, the government would grant to the bankers a charter to form a bank, a central bank. Three, the bank would be given an exclusive right to issue paper money in the name of England. Four, the money issued for commerce could exceed the amount of gold held in reserve. Got to have that. Five, the money issued for government would be backed by nothing except bills of exchequer, which means IOUs. Six, although this fiat money was to be created out of nothing and would cost nothing to create, the government agreed to pay interest on it at the rate of 8 1/3%. And seven, the bills of exchequer would also be used as reserves for creating additional loan money for commerce with interest due on that also, thus in effect collecting double interest on the same nothing. Actually, it was more than double, as we shall see in a moment. Now, William Paterson boasted of this beautiful little scheme when he printed and distributed a prospectus. They were looking for some investors in this Bank of England, and in the prospectus he said this, quote, "The bank hath benefit of interest on all monies which it creates out of nothing," end quote. The charter was issued in 1694, and with it the Bank of England, the world's first central bank, came into being. So what was the payoff? Now, each group had to get something out of this. The political scientists within the government had been seeking, as you remember, about £500,000 to finance the war, and they couldn't raise it. But now, with the Bank of England, the bank promptly issued to them £1,250,000, which was 2.5 times what they had originally sought. So the political scientists were very happy. Now, on the other side, the monetary scientists within the banks started with the relatively modest real investment of £72,000 valued in gold. The £1,250,000 that they gave to the government was over 17 times the amount of their capital. Now, with an honest money supply, where you could only lend what you had, their interest earnings at 8 1/3% would have been about £6,000. Not bad. But with the central bank mechanism, or the mandrake mechanism, they earned £104,000 in interest, a sum equal to 144% interest on their original investment. Now, this was both annual and compounded. But the best of all, Paterson's group still possessed their capital. You see, they hadn't lent it at all. So in reality, they didn't have to part with their capital. The real interest rate, therefore, was not a mere 144%. It was, in fact, infinity. Now, that is the financial power that the cabal obtained with the invention of the mandrake mechanism, the invention of the central bank, and it is the power it holds throughout the world today, only more so. Now, it's interesting that the net effect was that the men who masterminded this mechanism only a few years previously would have been imprisoned or hung for doing exactly the same thing for which they now were being knighted. And that too is power. It is the political power, and it is the secret science of money. Now, what happened? Very briefly, I don't want to bore you with the details. New money flooded into the economy. There was the sensation of prosperity. Everybody was having a ball. Prices went up, and all of a sudden, people began to have doubts about whether the bank really held enough gold in their vaults to pay everybody off should they want the gold. And of course it didn't. There was the inevitable, a run on the bank. This is the thing that puts shivers and chills into the spine of all international financiers, a run on the bank. Many banks failed, they closed their windows, there were near riots in England. I shouldn't say near riots, there were riots in England. And then there was a fateful decision. When the banks cannot honor their contracts to exchange paper money for gold because they have issued more promissory notes than there is commodity money or gold in their vaults, they actually should declare bankruptcy, because that is in fact what they are, and they should be forced to liquidate their assets like any other business that cannot cover its liabilities with its assets, and they should be allowed to go out of business like any other business that was either dishonest or corrupt or unprofitable. And by the way, had that been allowed to happen, I don't think we would be in the mess we're in today. Had this always been allowed to happen, whenever banks get into this situation, the people of the world would soon get the idea that banks are bankrupt if you don't watch them very carefully. They would be very careful about putting their money into banks. They would watch banks like used car dealers. And banks would have to toe the mark. And we would not have the kind of problem that we have today. But that isn't what happened. The precedent was set. Remember, the cabal is a partnership. It's not just the financiers. And each group is committed to protect the other. The politicians protect the financiers, the bankers, and the bankers protect the politicians. So the British government enacted legislation that allowed the banks to, as they call it, suspend payment in specie. Now, specie is a word which merely means gold, or whatever is being held as a tangible asset, as a reserve. So the banks were allowed by law, because of their partners in government protecting the bankers, they were allowed by law to do that which no other business is allowed to do, and that is to operate even though they are bankrupt. They were allowed to break their contracts with their depositors. They had entered into a contract with all depositors that they would redeem those banknotes in gold. And when they couldn't do it, the government said, "It's okay, fellas, go ahead anyway, and we protect you by law. Nobody can drag you into a court. Nobody can force you to do it." Thus, the banking industry at that point was legally protected in the marketplace and exempted from keeping its contracts. This was a fateful event in monetary history, because the precedent has been followed ever since. In Europe and in America, the central banks and their favored associate banks have always known that their partners in government will come to their aid when they get into trouble. They do not worry about that at all. They have been released from the need for honesty or restraint in their business practices. And this is the root of the economic crisis that we are facing in the United States today. Now, this master plan of the cabal was also seen in the French Revolution. That is a subject all by itself. It can be said, however, that the popular image of the French Revolution is not very accurate. Most textbooks describe the French Revolution as the popular uprising of the masses against a hated regime. This does not turn out to be quite true, to put it mildly. The popular uprising of the masses was engineered, and there was a lot of maneuverings behind the scenes, and it was not that at all. Getting back to Professor Carroll Quigley and his book, Tragedy and Hope, he touches on this subject on page 515, and this is what he says, quote, "At that date, financial power was in the hands of about 10 or 15 private banking houses, whose founders in most cases had come from Switzerland in the second half of the 18th century. These bankers, all Protestant, were deeply involved in the agitations leading up to the French Revolution. When the revolutionary violence got out of hand, they were the chief forces behind the rise of Napoleon, whom they regarded as the restorer of order. As a reward for this support, Napoleon, in 1800, gave these bankers a monopoly over French financial life by giving them control of the new Bank of France." So there's just a little quick glimpse. We see how these financial powers can be behind the scenes, manipulating things as massive as a French Revolution and gaining complete control over the economic life of a nation as a result of it. Those same forces remain in control of the economic life of France today, even though the central bank theoretically has been nationalized by the French government, if you look at it very carefully, you'll see that the same cabal is very much in control. Now, any discussion of Napoleon or the central banks must lead eventually to the name Rothschild. It was Meyer Amschel Rothschild who said, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws." In his biographical study entitled The Rothschilds, Frederick Morton concluded that the Rothschild dynasty had, and these are his words, "conquered the world more thoroughly, more cunningly, and much more lastingly than all the Caesars before or all the Hitlers after them." Now, the dynasty was begun in Frankfurt, Germany, in the middle of the 18th century by Meyer Amschel Bauer, who was the son of a goldsmith. Now, Meyer became a clerk in the Oppenheimer Bank, which was located in Hanover, and eventually was promoted to junior partner there. And after his father died, he left the banking house of Oppenheimer and returned to his home in Frankfurt. Now, over the door hung a red shield with an eagle as identification for the family business. Now, the German words for red shield, I believe, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, are Rothschild. So he changed his name from Bauer to Rothschild, as we call it today, and added 5 gold arrows held in the talons of the eagle to represent his 5 sons. Amazing sons. The Rothschild fortune began with the practice of what is called fractional reserve banking, which we had to skip over in our preliminary session. But basically, that boils down to the creation of gold receipts, promissory notes, which had no gold behind them. That's the bottom line. And then the collection of interest on those worthless receipts. It's an ancient practice well honored in the banking circles. The Rothschilds became prime lenders to governments all over Europe. His son set up operations in all the financial centers of Frankfurt, Vienna, London, Naples, and Paris, and they curried loans to heads of government and soon became prime lenders, I mean prime lenders, to such countries as England, France, Italy, and Germany. They were the financial power of Europe at that time. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're not just talking about ancient history. This dynasty is very much alive and well today. Nathan Rothschild opened up the London office of N.M. Rothschild & Sons in 1804. Today, almost 200 years later, at 10:30 every weekday morning, the international price of gold is fixed by 5 men sitting absolutely alone in a private room at the London offices of N.M. Rothschild & Sons. Cabal has an incredible continuity. Now, they say that one picture is worth 1,000 words. Then I suppose that's true, but then one example is worth 1,000 explanations. And I think the best example that could be offered would be the Battle of Waterloo in June of 1815 and the consequences. Now, Napoleon had come to power, as you recall, with the help of the Cabal. But now that he was in power, he was a threat to the balance of power. The balance of power means that nobody is very much stronger than anyone else, and therefore wars can go on indefinitely. If you've got one absolute strong man, that's Pax Romana. That's peace. Can't have that. So Napoleon was becoming too strong. He was threatening to conquer all of Europe, so they had to oppose Napoleon. That's the basic thing. Now, Napoleon saw this clearly because he knew these people, and toward the end of his career, he wrote these words, quote, "When a government is dependent for money upon bankers, they and not the leaders of the government control the situation. Since the hand that gives is above the hand that takes, money has no motherland, financiers are without patriotism and without decency, their sole object is gain." It's not surprising, therefore, that the House of Rothschild was active on behalf of England in this case against France, but not out of patriotism toward England, but for gain. And this was brought to focus in the campaign between Napoleon and Wellington. This was perhaps the greatest single act on behalf of the Rothschilds, which was to deliver £800,000 worth of gold to Wellington, who was attempting to build and equip an army in Portugal and in the Pyrenees Mountains between Spain and France. Now, to accomplish this, the gold had to move from England through enemy territory, right through France, to get to Wellington. Now, this wasn't too difficult for the Rothschilds to do because they were actively engaged in smuggling operations on a grand scale, I might add. I mean, ships loaded. They could get through almost any national boundary line because their red shield was recognized and respected by all governments. Don't forget, they were lending to all governments. They were friends to all governments. They were enemies of none. And in fact, all governments depended upon the Rothschilds not only for financial support, but also, in some cases, for supplies. So it was not a particularly difficult thing for the Rothschilds to move anything through enemy territory, because to them there is no such thing as enemy territory. A fact I hope you will not forget when we are talking about later events. At a dinner party in later years, Nathan Rothschild was rather boastful, and I can picture him sitting back in his chair, perhaps touching his fingertips together, and these were his words, quote, "The East India Company had £800,000 worth of gold to sell. I went to the sale and bought it all." Just like that. "I went to the sale and bought it all. I knew the Duke of Wellington must have it. The government sent for me and said they must have the gold. I sold the gold to them, but they didn't know how to get it to the Duke in Portugal. I undertook all of that and sent it through France. It was the best business I have ever done." End quote. Incredible, isn't it? Well, the best part, though, came after the Battle of Waterloo. You see, the battle itself was crucial to the financial standing of the British bonds. Just picture for a moment what would have happened had Napoleon been victorious. Here was England already in debt so far that they could never hope to repay it to the Rothschilds and others. And everybody is holding these government bonds, and England supposedly is paying interest on them. If they had lost the war, those bonds would have plummeted in value. Nobody would want them, because the credibility of England's financial power to pay on them would have been seriously questioned. On the other hand, if Wellington were to be victorious, the bonds would surge up in value. They were hovering somewhere, you know, in between, because nobody knew what was going to happen. But had he been victorious, they would have surged upward, and there would have been confidence again, because England would surely be one of the dominant military and economic forces in Europe. So, in this case, having prior information is pretty important. It was a well-known fact, because of Rothschild's ability to get through lines, and because they had a network of messengers all over Europe, it was a fact that Rothschild's messengers moved through Europe faster than anyone else, governments included. And it was generally expected that Rothschild, Nathan Rothschild in London, would be the first man to know the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo. And in fact, that is what happened. Rothschild's messenger arrived in London a full day before the official messenger of the British Army. And so when Rothschild went to the bond market in London on the morning of June 20th, all eyes were fixed on him. And he went to his pillar, where he had a little table where he normally did his trading, and he was observed to be very, very dejected. He didn't want to talk to anybody. He was very sad. He was holding his head. He was shaking his head. He was depressed, obviously. And then he started to sell. And then he sold some more. And the word went through the crowd like wildfire. Nathan is selling. He knows. Wellington lost. Well, you know what happened. What, within a matter of hours, the floor fell through the market, and everybody was selling their bonds for whatever price. Didn't make any difference. But you must realize that in order to sell, someone must buy. And who was buying? Well, they didn't know who these people were who were buying. There were new faces out there. Who are these idiots in there? Well, you know the answer already. They were Rothschild's agents buying up all the debt of the British government. And by the end of that day, ladies and gentlemen, the Rothschilds had purchased the English debt, and they did this at a fraction of what those bonds were worth. From that day forward, the Bank of England, England's financial life, and in fact, England itself, were effectively under control of the House of Rothschild. It was Nathan Rothschild himself who said, quote, "I care not what puppet is placed upon the throne of England. The man who controls Britain's money supply controls the British Empire. And I control the British money supply." End quote. That says it all. I have a very interesting question, kind of a philosophical question that leads to some practical answers. How is it that the cabal can induce governments to borrow money, to get into debt, and then to continue paying that debt through the Mandrake mechanism? And after all, the government has the power of armies, and it can simply tell the financiers to go take a hike. And yet, this doesn't happen. Why not? The answer to that question is what I call the Rothschild formula. And this was worked out in 18th century Europe and perfected in the intervening years. Now, what I'm going to read to you verbatim, and I'm going to read it verbatim because it took me a long time to reduce it down into very succinct language. I put myself in the position of what I would do if I were in charge or the head honcho of the cabal, and I had to explain it to one of my proteges so that he could understand it and continue on after me. How could I boil it down into a very succinct statement of procedure? And I came up with five instructions. So I'm speaking now as though I were advocating the Rothschild formula. One, war is the ultimate discipline to any government. If it can successfully meet the challenge of war, it will survive. If it cannot, it will perish. All else is secondary. The prosperity of its citizens and the solvency of its treasury will be quickly sacrificed by any government in its primal act of self-survival. Two, all that is necessary, therefore, to ensure that a government will maintain or expand its debt is to involve it in war, or the threat of war. The greater the threat, and the more destructive the war, the greater the need for debt. Three, to involve a country in war, or the threat of war, it will be necessary for it to have enemies with credible military might. Now, if such enemies already exist, all the better. If they exist but lack military strength, it will be necessary to provide them the money to build their war machine. If an enemy does not exist at all, then it will be necessary to create one by financing the rise of a hostile, warlike regime. Four, the ultimate obstacle is a government which refuses to finance its wars through the Mandrake mechanism. Although this seldom happens, when it does, it will be necessary to encourage political opposition, insurrection, or revolution to replace that government from the inside with one that will. The assassination of heads of state will play an important role in this process. Five, no nation can be allowed to remain militarily stronger than its adversaries, for that could lead to peace and a reduction of debt. To accomplish this balance of power, it may be necessary to finance both sides of the conflict. Wherever possible, neither side should be allowed a decisive victory or defeat. The objective is perpetual war. Now, I believe that says it all. And any protege of mine in the cabal who didn't understand that would soon be on the outside. It's very clear. And I think that if you hold that formula in mind, at least as a possibility, and take a look at history, the meaning of history suddenly becomes quite different than it had before. So let's do a little bit of that as time permits. We shall briefly examine the Rothschild formula as applied to four major periods of conflict: 18th century England, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and both world wars. Now, in 18th century England, Europe had always been at war, but not until the arrival of central banking and fiat money did it become institutionalized at such a high and consistent level. For example, the following incredible record occurred starting precisely with the formation of the Bank of England for the specific purpose, as you recall, of financing a war. That was the reason for the creation of the world's first central bank, was to finance a war. Okay, this is the record of England starting from that point. 1689 to 1697, the War of the League of Augsburg, King William's War. 1702 to 1713, the War of Spanish Succession, Queen Anne's War. 1739 to 1742, the War of Jenkins' Ear. 1744 to 1748, the War of Austrian Succession, King George's War. 1754 to 1763, the French and Indian War. 1793 to 1801, the War against Revolutionary France. 1803 to 1815, the Napoleonic Wars. Now, you add all that up. In the 126 years between 1689 and 1815, England was at war 63 of them. Now, that is one out of every 2 years in actual combat. The others were spent preparing for combat. A total war society. The mark of the Rothschild formula is evident in that period. The hand of the cabal was often seen financing both sides of these conflicts. There usually were no decisive victories or defeats, and the only tangible result was expanded government debt for all parties on all sides of the conflict. Now let's take a look at the Bolshevik Revolution, another example of the Rothschild formula, with particular attention to item number 4 on that list, which was the overthrow of a government that is not willing to finance its wars through the Mandrake mechanism, which was true of Russia at that time. Now, this is another one of those myths of history. The Bolshevik Revolution is often presented as an uprising, a popular uprising of the downtrodden masses against an oppressive government, just like the French Revolution. But the facts are, ladies and gentlemen, the planning, the leadership, and the financing came almost entirely from outside Russia, mostly from financiers in Britain, Germany, and particularly the United States. This really started with Jacob Schiff and the Russo-Japanese War of 1904. Much of Japan's funding for that war came from the financial house of Jacob Schiff. Actually, he was head of the U.S. investment banking firm of Kuhn Loeb Company. Now, this funding allowed Japan to field a superior military effort and to win the war. Now, in appreciation for this, the Mikado awarded Schiff the Second Order of the Treasure of Japan. Nothing particularly significant about that, except to illustrate how important the Mikado thought Schiff was in the financing of that war. Now, to the real leverage point. A ton and a half of Bolshevik revolutionary literature was sent to Japan by Schiff to be distributed among Russian prisoners of war held there. He also sent communist organizers into those prisoner camps to propagandize and recruit those prisoners into the Bolshevik cause. In effect, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of that war, there were about 50,000 officers and enlisted men who returned to Russia as seeds of revolution and played a decisive role several years later in the communist takeover of Russia. As you know, it was the turning of certain military regiments that was critical during the Bolshevik Revolution. These regiments were effectively converted to the Bolshevik cause because of this propaganda activity in Japan, financed and masterminded by Jacob Schiff. Now, between 1905 and 1917, Jacob Schiff of Kuhn, Loeb & Company also was the principal financial backer of the terrorist group in Russia called the Nihilists. Now, these people, these terrorists, changed their names historically from time to time. At that point, they were generally called Nihilists. They later became the Bolsheviks and later became the Communists. Every time there was a slight shifting or a reamalgamation of alignment of forces, they would change names, but they were basically the same group. And it was Schiff who was financing the Nihilists. Now, their mission was to assassinate heads of state. And this group, ladies and gentlemen, was organized in New York City. After Trotsky had been banished from France because of his revolutionary activities, he traveled to New York to meet with Jacob Schiff, and his travel expenses aboard the Montserrat, the ship, were paid by Schiff. After his arrival, Trotsky's mass meetings in New York City and his passage back to Russia were also financed by Schiff. After his return to Europe, several million dollars were placed at Trotsky's disposal by Schiff in a branch bank in Sweden. This is all a matter of very carefully, meticulously documented history. Now, on March 23, 1917, a mass meeting was held at Carnegie Hall to celebrate the first revolution. Remember, there were two revolutions in Russia. The first one involved the overthrow of the Tsar, in which a relatively moderate government came to power, the provisional government under Kerensky. And then that was later overthrown by the Bolsheviks and put firmly into the hands of communism. The second revolution was really more of a backroom, what would you call it? It wasn't a revolution at all. It was just a hijacking of a government. It was a very small-scale operation, involved very few people. But the nation was already prostrate with troubles and had no police force, no military might, and it was total chaos. So relatively easy to capture a new government with a few people. But the first revolution overthrew the Tsar, and at the end of that, there was a big celebration in New York City, of course. And Jacob Schiff sent a telegram to be read to the audience at that meeting at Carnegie Hall. In that telegram, he expressed his regrets at not being able to attend, and then he said that he described the revolution as, quote, what we had hoped and striven for these long years, end quote. It is also a historical fact that Schiff was a primary factor in financing the second revolution in Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution, which overthrew the Kerensky Provisional Government in October of 1917. Now, in the February 3rd, 1949 issue of the New York Journal America, Jacob Schiff's grandson, John Schiff, was quoted to the effect that his grandfather had given about $20 million for the triumph of communism in Russia. Just think of what $20 million was worth in 1917, 1916, 1914. Now, I want to point out, ladies and gentlemen, quickly here, that Schiff was not alone. There were other sources of funding within the cabal. Leon Trotsky, in his book, My Life, tells of a British financier who gave him about 21 million rubles. Now, this was undoubtedly Lord Alfred Milner. Now, we don't have time to talk about Milner, but Milner was one of the organizers and founders of the roundtable groups which evolved into the Council on Foreign Relations here in the United States. And if you don't know who Lord Milner was, you better find out. He was one of these dark, shadowy figures who wielded tremendous power well beyond his station because he controlled both money and politicians. Anyway, there was no doubt that the source of this funding was Lord Alfred Milner. Now, other sources of funding for the overthrow of the Tsar and the establishment of Bolshevism were Olaf Aschberg of the Nye Banken of Stockholm, the Rhine-Westphalian Syndicate, and a wealthy banker named Jivotofsky, whose daughter later married Trotsky. In Germany, the chief source of funding was an international banker by the name of Max Warburg, whose brother Felix was married to the daughter of Jacob Schiff. And his other brother, Paul Warburg, later was to become the chief architect of the Federal Reserve System here in the United States. Now, Russia was teeming with British and American agents at that time. There was no secret about this. There were many foreign reporters and observers who were sending back communiques, many of which wound up in the American press, some of which were private communiques. Many observers were telling how Russia was swarming with Americans and Englishmen. And these people had suitcases full of money, and they were handing out money to revolutionaries, primarily those in the military barracks, trying to get to incite them to revolution. One report said, for example, that British agents were seen handing out 25 ruble notes to the men at the Pavlovsky Regiment just a few hours before it mutinied against its officers and sided with the revolution. Now, on the American side of this little operation, this was all under the umbrella of what was called the American Red Cross Mission. Now, I'm not casting an aspersion on the Red Cross, because you understand that the Red Cross is made up of many different missions in different countries and so forth. And it turned out that the American Red Cross mission to Russia was a very special breed of cat. It had practically nothing at all to do with the Red Cross. It was made up of men who were disguised as Red Cross officials on a humanitarian mission, but the majority were composed of financiers, lawyers, accountants, and their staffs, and assistants who were representatives of New York's banks and investment houses. The entire expense of the American Red Cross mission to Russia was paid for by one man, and his name was William Thompson. Now, Thompson was ideal for a Red Cross mission. He was a close associate of J.P. Morgan, and he was the director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Now, doesn't that qualify him to run a Red Cross mission? So there he was. He was in charge, and he paid for it. I doubt if it all came out of his personal pocket, although much of it probably did. He expected to gain handsomely from his participation, but I think that there were others involved. Now, the assistant to William Thompson at that time, as head of the Red Cross mission, was a fellow by the name of Cornelius Kelleher. Kelleher, on reflecting on this episode at that time, wrote a book, and in this book he was describing one of the few dupes in the Red Cross mission who didn't understand what was going on. And he said, quote, "Poor Mr. Billings believed he was in charge of a scientific mission for the relief of Russia. He was, in reality, nothing but a mask. The Red Cross complexion of the mission was nothing but a mask," end quote. Well, what was the purpose of the mission then? It was clear. It was to channel funds into the revolution with local control on the scene by the men who were giving the funds, who could direct the revolution. As simple as that. Thompson himself gave over 2 million rubles to the Kerensky government and to the Kerensky regime for propaganda purposes inside Russia. He gave $1 million to the Bolsheviks for the spreading of revolutionary propaganda even outside of Russia, particularly in Germany and Austria, and this led to the abortive German Spartacus revolt of 1918. So it wasn't just Russia they were interested in. They want Bolshevik revolutions everywhere. And they tried it in Germany. It failed. And all of this was reported widely in the American press at that time. Now, when Thompson returned to the United States, he put a man in charge of the mission by the name of Raymond Robbins. Now, Robbins was the personal protege of Colonel Edward Mandel House.